Session number 21065, Reel 4.
Colonel Jenkins, Reel 4. I think there's something you want to go back to regarding the Malayan emergency.
I was just going to cover something that happened. I don't know whether it was 1949 or 1950, the very early days in Malaya, when I was the IO and we were sent out on a patrol. There'd been something suspicious happening. I think it was on the 51st milestone on the Durian Tipis Road. And it's typical of the sort of things that were happening in those days. I had my INT section of about seven soldiers. And there was a civilian who had been a planter called George Leonard. And he had been seconded to the police. And he and another planter were called the Marx Brothers, as far as we were concerned. Their names weren't actually mentioned, but the one that I knew particularly well was George Leonard, and he was seconded to me with this to go and look at something around the 51st milestone where there'd been some rather suspicious movements. So we had about seven Gurkhas and George Leonard, and we got out of our trucks near a logging station and moved into the jungle with about 4 days' rations, I suppose. And after we'd crossed a bit of open ground, there was some movement in the bushes ahead, and a man was in green was seen to jump up from position and run away, and he was in olive green. And a couple of soldiers went after him, and he was shot and killed. And he proved to be a fully dressed communist terrorist. He was one of an armed CT. So this was a fact that he was obviously there as a sentry. So we moved into the jungle, and it was we started off along the path, going very very slowly, very cagey business. And then we fanned out to the side so that we weren't an obvious target. But after we'd gone in about 200 yards, I suppose, you get quite confident in a way. And we were slightly closer together. When we came across in rather dense jungle, a sort of pool of water. We'd been on patrol for most of the day, I suppose, by then. And we were going round the edge of this pool when all hell broke out. And we were caught in some pretty heavy fire. The rifleman standing next to me, who was my batman, was shot in the head, and he fell over into the water. And the noise was absolute chaos. By the time we had regrouped, which was a few minutes later, I suppose, because you couldn't see anything. There was no visibility. We were in dense jungle, secondary jungle. We eventually found that ahead of us, there were three enormous emplacements, sort of positions built out of logs and clay. And George Leonard, who had quite a lot of experience, he'd been in Force 136 during the Malayan, the time of the war against the Japanese. He saw this as being something pretty big in terms of a communist terrorist base. So a decision had to be made then as what we did. Well, there were seven of us, he and I, and an unconscious soldier shot in the head, some distance from the roadhead. We arrived at the decision that there was no way that we could, with this depleted, a wounded man, leave him and go and onwards along the path to away from this position. So we decided to go back to the road and to get a force to look at this, to see what was the other side of these huge great bows, this emplacement. And we started evacuating the soldier. It took us about 3 hours to get him back to the road. Of course, there were only seven of us, and he had to be pigged. He was unconscious, so he had to be strapped to a log and carried over on shoulders. We got him to the road, and this was milestone 51, and that was milestone 51 from Seremban. So we had a long journey down to Seremban, and he died just before we got to the hospital. His name was Budiman Tamang. And just digressing for a moment, five years later, when I was paying out recruits in Nepal, quite a coincidence, the first widow I paid was the wife of that rifleman, Budiman Tamang. Quite extraordinary coincidence. But anyway, after he was, we dropped him off at the hospital, and he was dead then. We went back to the battalion, adjacent lines, and within 12 hours, they had a company group formed back up to the 51st milestone and went in through the jungle along the same path, very cagely, past these great emplacements that had been built, and which would obviously was their guard post. And then about 200 yards further on a clearing, a knoll in the jungle, there was a camp there for about 150 terrorists, which had been evacuated the previous day. And it's a pity that we couldn't have done something about it earlier, but they had gone north. And there was a follow-up, but the contact wasn't made. But we got a few bits of ammunition, parts of an LMG. We had a large communist flag, which is now, in fact, in the Gurkha Museum in Winchester. But it was just one of those little incidents that you that come right out of the blue. It was unfortunate that the first contact was me and my intelligence section rather than a company. But as a result of that, of course, you evacuate your wounded man who subsequently died, as I say, but you lose the initiative of being able to do anything quickly to get at the main force. There was no way that we could do that. But that was just something that happened in those very early days, and it was either 1949 or 1950. But it's something I shall always remember, the 51st milestone on the road there, Kalipilo Road.
Now, the Borneo confrontation in the 60s, can we deal with that and how you came to be involved, please?
The Borneo confrontation, I was in England for the first phase of that, which was the 1961-62 sort of time, when there was the second Gurkhas were involved, I think, initially in some actions, and one of their subalterns, young Stevens, I know, was killed in those very early days. But I went out to join the battalion in 64. And we all did a number of tours out there. You did 5 months, I think, active touring in Borneo, and then you had a retraining period of something like 2 months or 3 months back in your base, which our base at this time was Kluang in Malaya. So I went out just, I think, about Christmas, just before Christmas in 1964, and we had these battalion headquarters was in Kuching, and the companies were out, forward companies were up just this side of the Borneo and Indonesian border. Big company bases, there was Sarikin and Stas, I'm forgetting their names now, but these were company bases. And battalion headquarters was in Semengo camp in near Kuching. And they were heavily defended, sandbag defences. They had gunner support from the Kuching area. You had an FOO, an observation officer, with your company base. You had machine gun posts on all the corners, fully sandbagged, fully protected. And the idea being that you would basically, from this base, patrol the Indonesian border and make sure there was no incursions into Borneo. And you did a tour of about 5 months, I suppose, in these bases. The first one I was in was in a place called Sarikin, which must have been about 2 miles inside the in our side of the border. And my job really was to safeguard the integrity of the border in my company area, which was probably about 4 or 5 miles of border. And you do that by active patrolling, by sending out listening posts, by supporting the SAS Special Air Service patrols that were operating in the area. And of course they were crossing the border and coming back, and you were inserting them and meeting them on their way out and that sort of thing. And that's really our role at that time. We had gunner support from the big guns at the back. Your FOO would register his guns. We'd arranged that we'd have no patrols out and that he should fire his guns, real ammunition, and had his defensive fire tasks all around your company base, so that if you were under pressure, he should bring in firepower to, in support of your base. And that really was what we were doing. We took an airdrop every 5 or 10 days, and all communication was by helicopter, moving people and stores and visitors and what have you. But generally speaking, it was an observation role on the border.
What rank did you have by then?
A company commander major.
Which company did you have?
I had B Company at that stage.
Did you go out with them? To
oh, yes. Yes, we certainly. Yes, we had a lot of patrols. And in fact, subsequently, I mean, that was the first tour that I did. I mean, there were lots of other tours. There were three more tours after that. And of course, as Borneo progressed, as we all know now, the Claret operations, that's what they were called. This was the cross-border operations into Indonesia, became more and more apparent. We did a lot of those as well.
Did you have any contacts with the Indonesians?
My company did. I personally didn't. We had at Seriki, the one I've been talking about on our first tour, we had a contact on what we call the Jagoy Ridge, where one of my platoons was involved with a firefight with some Indonesians. And we brought, I was in the command post in Seriki, and with my FOO, we brought some supporting fire down on the ridge on the enemy to relieve the pressure on the platoon. And that was the sort of things that were happening. There were a lot of activities in other parts of the border. There were a lot of contacts. But basically at that time, in those early days, 64, we were, generally speaking, the number of cross-border operations were quite limited compared with what they were later on in the later parts of 64 and 65.
What would be the object of the Claret operations?
Well, they were purely to try and make contact with the warring types of the Indonesians on their side of the border, the Claret operation, to prevent them creating a nonsense in on our side of the border. I mean, there was always the view that that the elements that were fighting from Indonesia were out to take over Borneo with Labuan and Kuching. How true that was, I don't know. But we basically were doing active patrolling looking for intelligence. I think that's really, you were trying to find out what was going on, more or less.
What opinion did you and the others have about the Indonesian enemy and their quality?
We didn't have a lot of information about them, in fact. There were one or two actions which they had fought, not with my people, but with other companies, where there was a strong firefight and people had been hurt, but and casualties on both sides. But I couldn't say it was a war. It was a skirmishing more than anything else, I think, at that time. But we did have these company bases right along the border, and they were there for the security of Borneo itself. The SAS did a lot of work on a lot of intelligence work by crossing the border and seeing what they could find out. And they used to, our job basically in those early, in those days, was to insert them, to put them in and with security and then to meet them coming out. So that was really what we were doing. But then we would go back to Malaya, we would retrain, we would the CO would decide what lessons had to be learned for the next phase. We were all the company commanders were asked to write up different training and tactical points, I think if they were called, in which of anything that had happened which you thought we could learn something from and pass on to other battalions and our people in our own battalion, we would do that in training. So we that's what we were doing when we were out and back in Kluang doing our rest period of whatever it was, 2 or 3 months. And then we would go back. We'd go back to a different division. I went back to the second division, Padan, on my second tour. And there we had a very big operation planned. This was the time when claret operations were very much to the fore, when I took two companies two SAS groups of Fijis I suppose it must have been 10,000 metres into Indonesia to there was a reported group of people there in a village who were getting ready to do an incursion into Malaysia, and it was to stop them, I suppose. We spent we had to carry 10 days rations, which was quite a heavy load. And we eventually got to the place where they were supposed to be based, and they had disappeared about 3 days prior to that. So that was a wasted journey, but it was quite an arduous trip. There were a lot of mountains and big hills, and the battalion put up guns on the border so that if we wanted any gunner support, we could have it. But we found absolutely nothing.
What was the attitude of local villagers towards the Indonesians?
Well, I suppose in a way it would have been the same attitude to the local people on our side of the border to our presence. You have soldiers based near your kampong, whatever it is, and you. In one way, you're delighted they're there for security purposes, and you do your best to feed them and look after them and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, they would prefer that the need for them to be there wasn't apparent. So that you didn't get any... either way, I don't think there was a feeling of emptiness or of great friendship. It was just a fact of life that they were there. Towards the end of the Borneo campaign in 1966, my company, BKW, was in Bakalawan, which is in the up on the eastern end of Borneo, the Borneo border, and we got information that there was a Lieutenant Sumbi who was. Indonesian trained in the jungle warfare school in Malaya, as a matter of interest, setting up a party of about 50 people to come and to come across our border and make his way to Labuan and create trouble. And the Gurkha Parachute Company were the first. He actually did come over with his group through Bakalawan, adjacent to Bakalawan, where my company was based, and made contact with the Gurkha Parachute Company, and my battalion was put on 100% alert to try and cope with this incursion of 50 under Lieutenant Sumbi. In fact, the Gurkha Parachute Company were the first people to make contact, and gave most of the information, and wounded, I think, one of the incursion number. And then the reports got pretty vague, but Colonel Carroll, who was commanding the battalion, deployed the battalion all over the division, the 5th Division, to try and locate Sumbi and his party, a big party, 50 people. And eventually information came in that he was right in the depths of the jungle, somewhere near the Brunei border, or heading towards the Brunei border. And I was summoned to battalion headquarters and asked to take in a couple of platoons to do the follow-up of this incursion crowd from Bacalhau. This we did in I think it was the end of August in 1966, and eventually we picked up tracks, and a lot of other platoons were involved in trying to locate Sumbi and his party, and after a great deal of hammering about in the jungle and information, we eventually caught up with him in September, and the whole of the 46 of his incursion group were accounted for, and the other four were picked up by the Malay police. So the whole of the incursion was destroyed.
Were you in the shooting yourself?
No. It was strange enough that the whole of the follow-up that we did, which I was involved in with a small group of people, we had no contact except when we came across people who had surrendered in this large group, or people who had succumbed to the rigors of their journey. They were all armed, but we had no firefight. It was quite an extraordinary follow-up. But I suppose it's true to say that we didn't know that when we were following up the party. We were on the sort of, we were careful all the way. It took quite a long time to do. We were sort of involved for nearly 2 weeks, I suppose, on this follow-up. But eventually it was a great success, and Sumbi was interviewed. And he gave a lot of information. It was a very successful operation.
You mean you captured Indonesians who'd collapsed?
Yes, some of them had died. It was quite an incursion that he had led. He'd been at it for a number of days, and he was heading for Brunei. It was quite an operation.
How did you come to leave the army and the Gurkhas?
Well, I'd come to the end of my normal regimental service. I commanded the battalion in Hong Kong in the early 70s, and by 1971 I had finished my tour of command. So I came back to Virtual to do staff work in the United Kingdom. I had about four different staff appointments in the UK before I eventually left the army in 1979.
We haven't said anything about the Gurkha soldier himself and his character and qualities. Perhaps we could finally say something about that.
Well, of course, I suppose in my opinion, he's the finest soldier that there ever has been, ever will be. He is comes from a country which is a hard country. It's very mountainous. It's a country which has not seen any great development over the years. The villages are miles apart on rugged terrain. It is subsistence farming of chickens and pigs and that sort of thing. There are very few medical resources in the hills. The valley of Kathmandu, of course, is different, and I'm excluding that from my comments. That is a difference from the hills. But the hills are extremely rugged, and the Gurkha soldier is what he is, I think, because of that very rugged upbringing. He's a marvellous person to serve with. He's very tough. He's got a tremendous sense of humour. And I suppose it's fair to say that of all the troops that have served alongside British soldiers over the years, the guy who gets on best with British soldiers than anybody else, the British soldier gets on best with Gurkhas. They have a very similar sense of humour, and wherever they've been, they've been splendid allies and partners.
Just going back to the Second World War, I presume that you were living in the Prestatyn area during the Second World War.
That's true, yeah.
Did the war much affect you?
Not at all. I was in the, I forgot what it was, I was a messenger in the air raid precautions thing on my bicycle. We had one bomber from Liverpool unloaded its bombs on the rubbish tip in Prestatyn at some stage during the early 40s. But that, as far as that was concerned, that was my experience of war.
Whereabouts was the rubbish tip?
It was in Prestatyn, but a long way from where I lived. But we heard the bombs drop.